Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I have the great honor of being here with Dr. Steven Pinker. He is a Johnstone Family Professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University, and he is also the author of several books, including the most recent one, Enlightenment Now: The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. And we're going to cover some topics of that book today, and also some other topics from other work of his today. So, Dr. Pinker, as I said, it's an honor to have you on the show, so thank you a lot for taking the time.
Thank you, Ricardo.
Okay, great. So, I mean, I think that you've already been asked this question several times before in different ways, but now I'm going to try to have a new take on it. That is, in your book, and also in The Better Angels of Our Nature, you already do this, you give us sort of an account of the development and history of the ideas of the Enlightenment. But there are some people that sort of question your narrative, let's put it that way. And more recently, there has been some work done by Joe Henrich and others, where they go back, they take a cultural evolutionary perspective on things to try to understand where the weird psychology, the Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic psychology comes from. And they pinpoint some influences coming from the Catholic Church in Europe, for example, and how it sort of undermined the kinship or the kin-based system that people had there. And eventually, I mean, it's a little bit complicated to explain here. It would take a while, but eventually they say, Joe Henrich and his collaborators, that it was that led to the cultural evolution of our weird psychology. And so things related to individualism, for example, analytical thinking, and all that we associate also with the Enlightenment idea. So I would like to ask you, if you read the work, what you think about it, and if you think that in any way it would go against your take on the Enlightenment.
Oh no. Well, for one thing, it can't be that you cannot credit the Roman Catholic Church with the Enlightenment, because they fought the Enlightenment tooth and nail, and they burned people at the stake. They showed Galileo the instruments of torture. They excommunicated or put on the index many of the thinkers and writings of the Enlightenment. I think there, and to this day, a major source of opposition to a secular humanistic basis of morality comes from the Catholic tradition that we humans are too intellectually and morally feeble to come up with a system of morality, and it is only a institutional tradition of deference to an authority greater than ourselves, such as the Roman Catholic Church, that keeps us moral. This indeed is a source of intellectual source of the reactionary conservatism that lies behind lay behind the presidency of George W. Bush, who was influenced by anti-Enlightenment Catholic philosophy in the form of the journal First Things. And to the extent that you could say that Donald Trump has intellectual foundations, he certainly has advisors who consider themselves intellectual. They are very largely influenced by this Catholic counter-Enlightenment tradition. Now, I do think there is some truth to, there's a grain of truth to the idea that in order, as a necessary but far from sufficient condition for the Enlightenment, there had to be a weakening of ties based on kinship, on blood, on clan, all of the institutions of modernity, such as democratic government, and for that matter, any institution, hinge on the weakening of our evolutionarily programmed ties of kinship and blood. This is a point made before before Joe Henrich and his collaborators, by the anthropologist Laura Betzig, by the journalist Ferdinand Mount in a brilliant book called The Subversive Family, where he pointed, and Henrich et al. Reiterate this, that because the natural way of forming alliances is through blood, any institution that seeks to form a larger polity, such as a nation, such as a religion, such as an army, such as a scientific community, has to cut across these nepotistic ties. And indeed, Catholicism did so. Catholicism was an attempt to weaken patterns of inheritance of land that worked against the interests of the Catholic Church as a rival institution. And it's often been said, there are data showing that parts of the world that still have blood ties, such as many parts of the Middle East, where there's a lot of cousin marriage, which further knits clans together, because even your son-in-law is biologically related to you if you have cousin marriage, are often resistant to Enlightenment values, such as tolerance of secularism, equality of the genders, tolerance for gay rights, raising children in a spirit of independence rather than obedience. All of those negatively correlate with the prevalence of cousin marriage. I'm skeptical that Catholicism deserves a lot of the credit, because some of the remaining quasi-tribal societies, like Sicily in the first half of the 20th century, as captured by fiction like The Godfather, emphasized the tension between ties of blood and ties of national obligation. The famous scene in which Michael Corleone enlists in the army after Pearl Harbor, and his brother says, your country ain't your blood. Did you go to college to get stupid? Beautifully captures the tension between traditional ties based on blood and obligations to country. So indeed, the Enlightenment depended on that weakening of nepotistic altruism, giving perquisites based on relatedness as opposed to merit, power based on size of clan loyalties, but it certainly was not sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I have this question for later, but maybe I will introduce it now. So since you mentioned that probably the Catholic Church, as Henrich et al. Had some sort of influence on undermining this sort of kinship-based system, and so it was what eventually led to our weird psychology, at least according to them. Do you think that in any way what could have happened is that the Catholic Church, via some sort of cultural process, changed the ecological circumstances where we lived, and then that's what would be behind the development of the Enlightenment ideas, in the sense that it would have created an ecological space, let's say, different kinds of social dynamics for us to be able to develop those ideas, or what do
well,
you think?
Well, it's hard, since history only played itself out once, and we can't tease apart the various things that historically conflated, such as Catholicism with all of its doctrines, and the fact that it was a transnational institution that necessarily had to undermine ties based on blood in order to have a society-wide, indeed continent-wide, a network of influence. It may not have been the doctrine of the Trinity, it may not have been the authority of the Pope, but it may have been any superordinate institutional structure. And again, in the history of the ideas that we consider central to the Enlightenment, including democracy, capitalism, individual rights, science, secularism, it was really the Protestant countries of Northern Europe, far more than the Catholic countries of Southern Europe, that were in the vanguard, and that even today, according to the World Value Surveys, it's the Protestant regions that are most committed to liberal, emancipatory, Enlightenment values. So I think Catholicism, even though it was the only thing going in Europe until the Reformation, and obviously it was a necessary condition to many of the things that followed, but it certainly was not a sufficient condition.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was probably a necessary one, but not a sufficient condition.
Certainly not sufficient, because they opposed it tooth and nail.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So let me ask you now, since we are talking about a cultural evolutionary approach here, coming from the work by Henrik et al., what do you think about cultural evolution and the effects that it might have on the evolution of our human minds? That is, you usually start from an evolutionary psychological perspective, and you say that, for example, most of the psychological mechanisms that operate in our minds are very old. They come from the Stone Age or the Pleistocene or whatever. But there are people out there like Henrik and Richardson and Boyd that defend another kind of view. They sort of say that cultural evolution might also work more quickly, more than genetic evolution, and can change also how our minds work, and can even create novel cognitive or psychological mechanisms. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's certainly phenomena of history that operate at a far greater time scale than biological evolution. So in a sense, cultural evolution exists in the sense that there's change over time that is not due to genetic changes. I'm skeptical that that there's a strong analogy to biological evolution, though there's unquestionably history. In fact, the whole point of my books, The Better Angels of Our Nature and Enlightenment Now, was that there are profound historical changes in domains such as violence and literacy and ethical values. This is not by no means a contradiction or even intention with the idea that the mind evolved powerful cognitive abilities. The only reason that we have language is to allow us to exchange products of culture and to create culture in the networks of sharing of ideas and values that language makes possible. So it's clearly true that our society is very different from the Pleistocene, and that's among the many reasons that I wrote these books. I'm skeptical that Darwinian natural selection offers a particularly good analogy to historical developments like the Industrial Revolution, the Enlightenment, the Military Revolution, the Civil Rights Revolution, although these obviously were not biological changes. They occurred far too rapidly to be explained by the turnover of genes from generation to generation. But they operate very differently from random mutation and selection by predominance in a population. Cultural change is Lamarckian in the sense that the adaptations develop in response to a need. Obviously, they are acquired changes are inherited. The mutations, at least the analogy of mutations in the realm of culture, are highly directed. They are not random in the sense of being blind to their effects. And that's simply because brains themselves, which are products of evolution, are what propel the process of cultural evolution. Namely, we're faced with problems, we think up solutions, some of the solutions work, some of them don't, but we don't flail around at random. Moreover, we don't pass them along through our children via the germline, but by explaining to them. And people can improve on innovations by combining them with other innovations, and based on mental models of how the world works and what is likely to succeed. We drastically cut down the combinatorially exploding search space of possibilities. There are, you're faced with a problem, whether it's hunting or agriculture or social cooperation. They're just an infinite set of possibilities. But we don't explore them blindly, the way our genomes mutate. We prune the search space by our understanding of how the world works. This is not incompatible with cultural change. This is what drives cultural change.
Yes, but let me just ask you again, just to emphasize this point. Do you think that it is in any way possible for culture or some sort of cultural force, cultural evolutionary force, to create novel psychological mechanisms, completely novel? I mean, something that is outside of the result of our biological evolutionary history?
Well, it depends what you mean by a new mechanism. So let's take reading, for example, which clearly is not part of our biological endowment. Kids don't spontaneously read the way they spontaneously speak. A large percentage of people are illiterate or dyslexic, much larger than the percentage of people who are dysphasic. All societies have spoken language. Only a small number of societies have developed written language. Is reading and writing a new cognitive mechanism? Well, in a sense it is, in a sense it isn't. It isn't because it draws on the sound pattern of language. There are no writing systems that go directly from visual marks to meaning. They always pass through sounds. There are, as far as I know, no one who can read without speaking or signing first. The design of alphabets depends on visual shape perception, and letter-like forms tend to resemble the kind of shapes that we have familiarity with. So it is a new assembly pieced out of existing cognitive mechanisms, and it may be a matter of semantics whether you call it a new mechanism or a new assembly built out of old mechanisms.
So, since one of the biggest topics in your more recent books is the one of morality and moral progress, and since, again, you usually take an evolutionary approach on things, or at least start from there, let me just ask you this. Do you agree when some people, like, for example, the philosopher Stephen Hales, say that we can't really have some sort of objective morality, or that doesn't exist because we have evolved a set of conflicting moral intuitions? Like, for example, we have some cognitive mechanisms associated with morality that are agent-centered. Like, for example, I think he gives the example of kin selection. I mean, we being preoccupied with the people that are part of our kin. And then on the other end, we also have agent neutral cognitive mechanisms, or a morality, agent neutral morality, when we think about things like reciprocal altruism, because that would basically allow for us to create or to expand our moral circle to include whatever person establishes that kind of relationship with us. So do you think that there's any merit to that idea, and that from an evolutionary perspective, the objectivity of morality is undermined or not?
No, I think the normative considerations of what we may deem objectively moral are at least conceptually different from our instinctive sense of what's moral. But the existence of moral intuitions that can be explained by evolution mean that we aren't born with an objectively correct moral understanding, but it doesn't mean that we can't strive for one. Again, assuming that notion is coherent in the first place, just as in other domains of reality, we may have intuitions that conflict with our best scientific and conceptual understanding. For example, we have a sense of number that partly share with other animals, a sense of exact numbers that limited to maybe two or three. We distinguish between two-ness and three-ness and oneness. We might have a sense of analog magnitude. Now, these aren't enough to do any serious mathematics, but we can develop and learn mathematics. We can overcome some of our mathematical fallacies and intuitions. That's what math education consists of. Likewise, we have a sense of the 3D structure of the world, but we're also vulnerable to visual illusions, and we figure out ways of overcoming our illusions. So it's at least conceivable that, yes, we do have very strong moral intuitions, but that we can override them by our best moral argumentation and consuming the results of prior moral argumentation. We can realize that our intuitions might be wrong.
Mm-hmm. So that objectivity would be based on a reasoning process, right?
Yeah, on the results of a reasoning process, mm-hmm. Yes. Letting loose our reasoning process and seeing what it comes up with.
Mm-hmm. And it would be basically a collective endeavor, because it would have to be the result of a collective of people negotiating what would be best for them, for example.
Well, yes. Like any domain of knowledge, you never have a solitary genius who's brilliant enough to figure it all out. You need an arena of debate, evaluation, to winnow out the bad ideas and let the good ideas float to the top. And morality itself, you could say, is inherently involves a community, in that if there was one person in the universe, one agent in the universe, it's not clear what morality would consist of. We almost define the notion of morality by how we treat others.
But morality is also a little bit complicated sometimes, because people might also use morality to justify violent acts or things like that. Like, for example, Alan Fiske well argued in his book Virtuous Violence, and he provides a lot of evidence there. So, I mean, whenever we talk about morality, people, I guess, usually associate it with being a moral person, that is, a good person, but that is not always the case.
That's right, and I made arguments that were similar to Alan Fiske's in The Better Angels of Our Nature, at one point saying the world has far too much morality, by which I meant has far too much indulgence in moral intuitions. That if you were to divide violence between that which is carried out of naked self-interest, you want something that someone else has, and so you kill them to steal what they have, one person forces himself sexually on another for the sheer sexual gratification. People keep slaves because they want the fruits of their labor. You look at all of those purely self-interested instrumental cases of violence. I estimate they probably account for a minority of all acts of violence, that probably the largest number of killings are not selfish, but come from implementing some notion of justice, some notion of utopia, some notion of the better life. So this is consistent with Fiske's point. In a lot of despots, totalitarian dictators, didn't necessarily have big harems and luxurious palaces. They were implementing what they thought their vision of a good society. A lot of the people who end up in jail aren't there because they killed a liquor store clerk so that they couldn't identify him in court, but rather they responded to an insult. They were fighting over a parking spot or a pool table or a romantic dispute, and they felt that it was just to kill the person who had crossed them. So perversely, not at all self-interested, but motivated out of moral conviction. And indeed, I suggested in both books that a lot of what we would call moral progress in a more or less objective sense, fewer people being murdered, people not being enslaved, people being free and autonomous, comes from actually repressing our moral instincts, deciding that what feels moral to us cannot be justified and therefore ought to be inhibited or even punished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. So changing a little bit topics now, we had this moral progress over the centuries or the millennia or whatever. So, but do you think that there's anything about our times that really can act as a safeguard against our sort of regressing significantly or even preventing us from going over the edge and or going extinct or something like that? I mean, do you think that there's really something now that we can be sure that that sort of thing will never happen, or is that too much for us to say?
Yeah, no, I don't think we can ever be sure that we won't backslide. And there have been many flagrant episodes in the past where societies have backslided, Nazi Germany being an example, the rise of totalitarian communist dictatorships in the middle decades of the 20th century, and in the case of violence, the great American crime boom from the 1960s to the early 1990s, the increase in civil wars in the developing world following decolonization from the 60s through the 90s. So there are, and in terms of just human well-being, human life, there have been pandemics like the Spanish flu epidemic, the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Africa, where life expectancy has gone into reverse. So there are many possibilities for backsliding. And they come about both because of just the nature of the universe, namely, the universe doesn't care about us. There are an awful lot of things, ways for things to go wrong. And as we are seeing, as you and I are speaking, new pathogens can develop virulence and resistance to medicines and public health measures. Countries can backslide into authoritarianism and into tribalism. Democracies can collapse and give way to anarchy, precisely because of the phenomena that we talked about, namely that the human intuition left to itself may not be particularly enlightened. We fall back into clan loyalty, into deference to authority, into conformity with social norms. There's a kind of Sisyphean struggle that we're always rolling the rock up the hill. And I don't think it's futile. We can roll it up farther each time, and it doesn't have to roll all the way back. Mm-hmm. But it always is a struggle. It's a struggle of education, of free expression of ideas and argumentation, of learning from mistakes, of being aware of what works and what doesn't. All of these are necessary to continue the upward advance against the forces that are always pushing it back.
Yes, but sometimes in your books, particularly when speaking about the political systems that we developed over time, you say that nowadays, and even more so in democracies, we have more checks and balances. So do you think that at least at a political level, that it would be harder nowadays than it was, I don't know, 70 years ago or 100 years ago for something like Nazi Germany or the Soviet Russia to occur or not?
I think it depends on the country, and we're getting a test right now in the United States where Donald Trump clearly has authoritarian tendencies in demonizing a free press, in demonizing his enemies and threatening to use the apparatus of the state against his political adversaries. All of these are the inclinations of a dictator. And a question that we've been living with in the United States for the last 3 years is, are the institutions of democracy, the checks and balances, the administrative state, strong enough to withstand these authoritarian tendencies? And so far, the answer is kinda, not bad. We don't have Nazi Germany in the United States. Not that Trump is anywhere near as bad as Hitler. He's genocidal. But he unquestionably has tendencies of the kind that we've seen in fascist autocrats. So far, the system seems to be holding. Doesn't mean that it would in a second term, necessarily. But at least the worst outcomes have been avoided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's hope for the best.
Yeah.
Okay, so talking about human nature again, there's this thing that we call, or we tend to call, common sense, that is the sort of collection of ideas that people have. And for example, there's folk psychology and the intuitions people have about how our minds and the minds of other people work, and their emotions and all of those things. There's an interesting thing in psychology, I guess, that I would like to ask you about. So there are instances where our intuitions are completely wrong, but there are other instances where it seems that it's easier for common people to have the right intuitions than even some academic people. Like, for example, there are situations where if a mother has more than one child, then she has better intuitions about, about behavioral genetics, for example,
yes,
and the fact that different people have different innate psychologies or innate personalities. That would be an example. So, do you think that our intuitions fall more on the right side or the wrong side in terms of our psychology?
Well, there's a vast amount of human behavior that is better predicted by folk psychology than by any scientific or academic psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Two people meet in a city that one of them is visiting. They plan it months ahead. They show up at the same bar at the same time, purely through verbal exchange of sounds and characters. That requires knowing that the other person wants to meet you, that the other person perceives the calendar the same way that you do, that they trust your own intentions to meet them, that are, when you think about how unlikely it would be to get two physical objects to end up, say, halfway across the country at the same, within a few feet of each other, 7 months in advance, if you were just lobbing, shells or something, you get an appreciation of how explicitly intelligent an ordinary human brain can be. And to any kind of cooperation, you and I were separated by thousands of miles of ocean. We managed to settle on a time and a means and a set of topics. And could any academic psychologist write down the rules that allow us to be here having this conversation? No, it's our folk psychology. You wanted to talk to me. You got your series. You want a variety of people. I'm interested in talking to you. I trust your intuitions. And that explains why we're here. And nothing can explain it any better. Now, not that it's magic, not that nothing could explain it, but there's a lot of sophistication of theory of mind, namely people understanding other people's beliefs and intentions that allow small-scale and large-scale social cooperation and cultural change to be possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I even recalled the new book by Hugo Mercier, Not Born Yesterday. I guess that would have something to do with it, right? Because he goes through several different sources of evidence where he really exposes the fact that we are not really that stupid, or at least as stupid as we think or the media portrays us or something like that, right?
Indeed, and I'm as it happens, I'm having Ugo as a guest lecturer in my course the day after tomorrow, so I'm quite familiar with his work. And indeed, it's easy. There is, of course, a tradition in psychology and behavioral economics, spearheaded by the brilliant Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, to highlight how many errors and illusions and biases and fallacies the human mind is subject to. And clearly we are. At the same time, we're far better than any robot, any artificial assistant, any artificial intelligence system at coordinating our behavior, bringing lots of information in the context to bear on a current problem in ways that are easy to underestimate. And although there are con artists who exploit people, you know, by and large, we make a living, we earn enough to eat, we have a place to live, we keep ourselves alive into our 70s or beyond, abilities that we have not been able to duplicate in artificial agents. So it does call for a degree of respect for human cognition.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So now talking about language a little bit. First of all, before I introduce the specific question I want to ask you, I wanted to start with this. Do you still hold the view that the correct way of looking at our minds is that we have massive modularity? I mean, that we are endowed with different domain-specific modules. I mean, I don't know how many, perhaps hundreds of them or thousands. I mean, do you still hold that view, or do you think that there are maybe some or more domain-general modules in our minds that you didn't think about before?
No, I actually never used the term massive modularity. That's only a term that has been used by people like Jerry Fodor to caricature views like mine, but I never used the term. And the term modularity, which Fodor himself endorsed in the case of language and vision, is not one that I ever embraced. I rather think of the mind as a complex system of subsystems and organs and tissues that are not completely homogeneous. I don't believe that we have one magical learning algorithm that is just trained with a massive data set and you get a human mind out of it. I do think the mind has structure. I think that there are different emotions, there are different motives, there are different ways of conceptualizing the world, but I don't think they're modular in the sense that they are uninfluenced by the inputs of other systems. So just to take it to be concrete, we have a notion of an artifact, of a tool, of a man-made system. That involves some degree of intuitive physics, if you will. That is, how does the physical world work? But it also has some sense of intuitive psychology. What is a purpose for which someone might have designed an artifact like a knife or a clock or a pot or a baby sling? So is that modular? Well, it's distinctive. I think our notion of an artifact is distinct from our notion of a living thing or from a piece of matter like a rock, but it is not modular in the sense that it is sealed off from our understanding of human intentions or from the physical world. It's got it's assembled from pieces of each. So the mind isn't it isn't spam, it isn't a uniform, but it isn't a bunch of chips that are separated, connected by a couple of wires either.
Mm-hmm. So you never liked the idea of the massive modularity of the human mind because Fodor basically presented it as modules that were encapsulated and so didn't really communicate with one another or something like that?
That's right. I think Fodor came up with his proprietary definition of modularity in his 1983 book and then projected it onto people who proposed that the mind had a great deal of structure in domains other than language and visual perception. But the notion of encapsulation was, I think, eccentric to Jerry Fodor.
Mm-hmm. Right. So now asking you about language. Okay, so I guess that you won't say now that language is a module, but anyway, you think of language as a specific cognitive mechanism that
a specialization or an adaptation. Okay. I don't think it's just now language cannot be modular in the sense that just by its very operation, it's mm-hmm. got to have a rich interface with knowledge, because we talk about anything that we know. Mm-hmm. It's have an interface with the motor system in order that we can articulate. It's got to have an interface with the perceptual system so that we can comprehend and read. It's got to have a interface with intentions, because when we speak, there's a particular message we want to get across, and there are particular effects that we have to have on our conversational partner. For that very reason, has to have exchange a lot of information with our social psychology, our social cognition, our theory of mind, so that we can get across what we want to in the limited time available. And that's why we leave so much out. We count on our hearer to read between the lines, to connect the dots, and that wouldn't work without an understanding of each other as social creatures. On the other hand, having all that knowledge is not enough to put together a grammatical sentence. And we know that people can have brain damage that affects their ability to speak but leaves their ability to understand the world intact, or vice versa. There are people who have forms of aphasia where they speak fluently and grammatically but don't make sense or are socially inappropriate. So I do think that language is specialization. It differentiates, say, humans from other primates far more than, say, understanding the physical world. It can be, there are reasons to believe that it's genetically not reducible to overall intelligence. There's language impairment is heritable, and language impairment is dissociable from overall intelligence. So there are reasons to believe that language is a specialization, but it couldn't be a module in the sense of having limited communication with the rest of the mind.
Mm-hmm. I understand. So, and do you think that the fact that we have this capacity to produce language in any way by itself allows for us to expand some of our other cognitive abilities? Like, for example, I don't know, do you think that it allows for us to expand our abstract abilities? I mean, our ability to think abstractly, for example.
Oh, absolutely. And that a lot of our abstractions we learn from people, we would not be able to come up with the theory of evolution or the theory of the laws of thermodynamics out of our own heads without having received many of the constituents from other people. As we engage in thinking and reasoning, we use language as aids in working memory, where we can keep the sound of a word active in mind as a way of holding that thought while we're engaged in other kinds of thinking. So there are many ways in which language may be necessary for abstract thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me ask you now about artificial intelligence. I know that many people have already asked you about this. What do you think, if you think that we can develop dangerous AI systems that can turn against us? And you say that, for example, sometimes probably, just to use the psychoanalytical term, we are projecting ourselves into systems that are different from us, that their brains, let's say, wouldn't operate in the same way. But let me ask you a different question. Do you think that if we were able to reproduce a human brain, but in some sort of artificial medium, let's say, for example, in silicon or something like that, and if it was exactly like ours, that is the same number of neurons, the connected the same way, the same structures and so on, do you think that if we were to turn that system on, that it would have the same kinds of mental experiences that we have?
Well, it would certainly have our cognitive abilities, our problem-solving abilities, our reasoning abilities. Depending on the thought experiment, whether it would actually have an inner life, that's whether it would be like something to be that android, is ultimately, I think, an unanswerable question. I think we would have very strong intuitions that it did, to the extent that it looked like us and acted like us. The intuitions would be probably irresistible if it was made of the same stuff as us. And indeed, if we could have, a 3D printer that, say, printed a human out of the same tissues and membranes, then I think it would be perverse to deny it consciousness, for the same reason that a human produced in the ordinary way through sex and birth we attribute consciousness to. Of course, in the case of humans, the other minds problem reminds us that we can't even be sure that someone else is conscious. You could be a solipsist in theory, but I think in practice, most of us are not solipsists. We do attribute consciousness to people who are certainly physically and functionally like us. So your, say, 3D printed android case, I think I would bet that they are conscious in the same, with the same confidence that I think you're conscious. Now, if it was made out of silicon, I think that would dent my confidence, although I'm not sure I could justify that decrement in confidence. Or if it was purely algorithmic, it was just running in the cloud, simulating our connectome and our neural network, would it actually be feeling something? There, my intuitions aren't grounds for much confidence. And I think that's why this is sometimes called the hard problem of consciousness. Hard, not in the sense of scientifically difficult, but in the sense of conceptually baffling.
Yeah. Okay, so just before we end the interview, I have two questions from a patron, Bernardo Seixas, so I'm going to read them. The first one is, Dr. Pinker, you are a famous advocate of the cognitive niche hypothesis, which states that selection for language and intelligence explains our ecological success.
And social cooperation, yes.
Okay. And then he adds that thinkers like Joe Henrich, Robert Boyd, and Pete Richardson have advocated a cultural niche hypothesis, which states that cultural learning is what really explains human success. Do you think their view has any merit? Do you think Henrich and other cultural evolutionists have provided useful new ideas?
No, I think it's a confusion. It's the same hypothesis. I mean, it's the same hypothesis. It is a case, I think, of academics kind of stoking a pseudo-controversy. The only reason that we have language is that we share ideas that collectively form a culture. So there's just no difference between the cognitive niche hypothesis and the cultural niche hypothesis. Even if you assert, as I would, as anyone would, that human life is massively shaped by culture, you need an explanation of why we have culture. How do we develop cultural ideas that are useful, that allow us to survive, to cooperate, understand our world? How do we successfully transmit them? To explain that, you'd say that we are a creature that is designed for culture by virtue of being innovative, by virtue of being social, by means of having the means to communicate. They're the same hypothesis.
Okay. So his second question is, a big problem with recent research in human nature is the so-called weird problem. That is, most samples come from Western college students. Do you believe that many results from evolutionary psychology may be proven false if tested in small-scale societies instead of Western samples?
Well, I think that the problem of testing ideas in Western societies is a real one, but it's perverse to lay that at the feet of evolutionary psychology, which is the branch of psychology that has done the most to avoid the weird society problem. Going back to the 80s, all of the foundational papers in evolutionary psychology looked at non-Western cultures. It's mainstream non-evolutionary psychology that has fallen prey to the weird fallacy. It is, you go back to the seminal works of Martin Daly and Margot Wilson, of Lita Cosmides and John Tooby, of Donald Simons, of Laura Betzig and Richard Alexander. All of them are steeped in the anthropological literature. Donald Brown, Napoleon Chagnon. They look at the Yanomamo, the San of Don Brown's cross-cultural universals. So yes, it is I completely agree that psychology should be much more oriented to non-Western cultures, but evolutionary psychology is the last branch of psychology that is guilty of that sin. It is mainstream social psychology that is the offender.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I mean, you mentioned all of those prominent anthropologists, but I even remember, I mean, reading a study done by David Buss back in the early 90s, where he went through samples from 37 different cultures or societies studying sex differences, for example.
An excellent example. That's right. Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay, so Dr. Pinker, I guess that we can end the interview now. I've already went through all of the questions that I had, and I thank you again for your time. Just before we go, would you like to mention, I don't know, some places on the internet where it would be easier for people to find your work or something like that?
Well, I have my own website, stephenpinker.com, hosted by Harvard University. So that's certainly a portal to my books, reviews of my books, responses to the reviews, articles, photographs, tweets, lectures. So that would be the portal I would recommend.
Okay, so I will include that in the description box of the interview, and also links to the rest of your work, which I really love. I'm really a big fan of yours, Dr. Pinker. So thank you again for taking the time to come on the show, and it was a pleasure to talk to you and to everyone.
My pleasure. The pleasure was mine, Ricardo. Thank you for having me.
Okay, guys, Steven Pinker on the show. I did it. I finally had him here. So, I mean, guys, this is really great. And I really need to ask you, please support the show. Go to my Patreon page or to any of the links I will leave in the description box. Links from PayPal for monthly subscriptions or for one-time donations or several times big donations, whatever you prefer. I would really like to get at $500 or $600 of support coming from Patreon by the end of this month. I'm now at $430 or something like that. And I mean, it would be great. And then by next month, if we could reach $850, I mean, it would solve many of my problems, really, guys. So please consider supporting the show. And otherwise, if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and supporters: Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Perga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Chantel Gelinas, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Janne Henninen, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, David Diaz, Anian Kata, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Henry Calinius, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Dr. Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves,
Max Bailby, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, my producers, Izar Webb, Rosie, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafiniak, Ilewelyn Osborne, Dr. Ian Gilligan, Sergio Condreano, Luis Caetano, and Matthew Lavender. And finally, my executive producer, Michal Rugieski. Thank you for all.